a warning?
There ain't nothing to worry about.
I worried that you work in an office, have children, celebrate wedding anniversaries. The world of heterosexual is a sick and horny lie.
Is that what I think it is?
You didn't think it was going to be that easy, did you? You know, for a second there?
Yeah, I kind of did.
Silly rabbit.
Tricks are for kids.
Welcome back to the show, listeners.
Welcome back, listeners.
It's our first episode in our new apartment.
We are recording in our new space. We moved earlier in the week, so NTMUG has a new headquarters,
new
and we're back in Pasadena.
Yes, again. Sort of. Listeners, I'm very excited to be in our new space. I know it sounds like we're moving all the time. We're not. Don't worry. We're not boxcar hobos. We just, we found something new that we like, and here we are. Here we are. Got a great movie.
We do. A movie that I have wanted to do on the podcast for a while, but I wasn't quite sure how we would do it. And then I kind of like mid-move, I was just like, you know, I think we're just going to pull the trigger on the Kill Bill episode. So, listeners, you're welcome.
Sounds
good. We're going to talk about Quentin Tarantino on the podcast, finally.
I can't believe we haven't talked about anything. Well, listeners, you're in for it. My name's Pete.
And I'm Scott, and these are the movies that made us gay. And we got to the Kill Bill episode, written and directed by Quentin Tarantino, released October 10th, 2003. Pete.
Yes.
This movie came out when I was a senior in high school.
It absolutely
and
did.
And I would have watched this movie early 2004, so that means that I have been out of high school now almost 20 years. Not quite 20 years. Let's give it a few months.
All right.
But it is one of my big
movie
regrets that I did not see either of these movies on the big screen. I've never seen them in a movie theater.
Okay.
I've always known them from home video.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Was it just not playing in your town?
So it... the Judith Theater never got it for, I don't know, various reasons. Maybe just the print the Judith Theater would have owed too much back on, so they just didn't bother getting it.
Okay.
But, I never saw this in the movie theater. I remember the weekend that it came out because I was in Missoula visiting Nicole, and it was like a family trip that I was kind of at the mercy of, like, my mom and my sister, so I just can't really drag them to go see Kill Bill,
sure.
Even though I think that they both would have been into it had I...
I also think that there have been several times in your history where they're just like, we'll see you in 2.5 hours. Have fun watching this movie.
But definitely not the case because like I would have had to miss dinner. So I did not make it to volume one. I remember a friend of mine, pretty much the only person that I knew that saw this movie early was my friend Dan in high school.
Uh-huh.
And I remember him telling me all about the big last act of the movie with Lucy Liu, of just all of the crazy blood, Vivica A. Fox is only in the opening scene. And I'm like, oh my God, I cannot wait. So I was working at the movie store when this came out. I did get to take home the DVD early.
Okay.
So when we got it that Friday, I got to take it home on the weekend.
Before the Tuesday release.
Before the Tuesday release.
And that was the first time you saw it.
And that was the first time I saw it. Immediately obsessed with it. I always think of this movie kind of as very kind of forming for me as a young person in high school, just because this movie was everywhere when I was a senior in high school. We were all talking about it. I always think of Kill Bill Volume 1 and Return of the King just kind of being these massive movies when I was finishing up high school.
Right. Mm-hmm. I saw this in the theater.
Yeah. Do you remember who you saw?
I took my younger brother to see it, who's your age. I'm pretty sure I had seen it before that, and I was just like, oh, this is really good. He was like super into anime. and he was into like kung fu movies, and so I was like, okay, I'll take my brother, but I don't remember who I saw it with the first time. But I took my younger brother, and who's your age, and driving home, he was like, yeah, it was really cool. I was like, okay, good. I'm glad you liked it. And he's like, it was a lot, though. I was like, yeah. And he said that, he said that it was almost too violent, and there were parts where he was just like, all right, we can tone it down a little bit. This is getting crazy. So I think he was a little overwhelmed by the, the albeit stylized violence and gore. I think even he was a little bit like, wow, this is too much. Meanwhile, I was just like, cool, just like blood fountains, like spurting everywhere, like whatever, you know. but he didn't really have the like massive horror kind of like foundation that I had. He was never really into horror movies, but like I said, he wasn't into kung fu stuff, but I don't know, maybe the ones that he was watching were like on TV or something. So but yeah, I remember him just being like, I liked it, but it was a little over the top. I was working at Blockbuster Video in 2003. They had these adhesive vinyl like posters that would go in the windows, and they were broken up into pieces because the windows had like segments, right?
Yeah.
And so the big Kill Bill one was like the size of a wall, and I was like, I'm taking that home.
I want to say that I took home a few posters from Kill Bill,
and the store manager was like, whatever, that's fine. So I took them home, and I was able to put two of them together, and it was like floor to ceiling, and it was Uma in the yellow, and it was on a yellow background. But I didn't do the other two pieces because it was just the logo of the title, just said Kill Bill Volume 1. So I was like, I can leave that. I don't have enough wall space. I'm going to put this up. And it was a little wonky because it was like this heavy, thick vinyl, but that was meant to stick on the window. And once we took it down, it was a little floppity. But it was really cool. It was up, you know, at home for a while, and then it just eventually came down because it was too much. But I was super into this movie. I was telling you as we were watching it to kind of prep for the episode, I've seen this movie multiple times, multiple times, probably upwards of 10 times. But I feel like I've only seen Volume 2 a handful of times, maybe 3.
Yeah, kind of the same.
This movie, I feel like, especially after you watch Volume 2, they're so wildly different in tone and structure and pacing. This one just feels like, I don't know, it almost doesn't even feel like, obviously, it doesn't feel like a complete story. It's not a complete story. Watching the movie going, okay, trying to piece together what you can piece together before Volume 2 is released. You're just like, what am I watching? Who are, you know, what, trying to figure out the storyline. And I think, like with Pulp Fiction, they do a good enough job in letting you as a viewer kind of understand enough of the story to get by until the very end when you can really piece it all together. I still don't know if I understand why, like, what is the purpose? Like, what was the reason of non-linear storytelling? Sure. Other than just like, oh, that was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I feel like
non-linear storytelling just in general or in the work of Quentin Tarantino?
In general, okay. Why? like, unless there's a very specific reason, you know, things, you know, spoilers, things get, you know, kind of revealed in a certain way. But I feel like if this movie was just chronological, I don't know. I guess it makes sense. I mean, just even with something like Star Wars or, you know, but something like this, it's like, I guess it's more impactful starting from where it starts and revealing, you know, the bride's like storyline. But
I guess it keeps the storytelling interesting, I guess.
Yeah, I just feel like, is it a gimmick? I don't know. I'm sure. Okay, this is Quentin Tarantino that we're talking about. This is Kill Bill that we're talking about. I'm sure there have been master's degree thesis papers.
I mean, he kind of changed the game in narrative storytelling in movies with something like Pulp Fiction too.
Right. And even with Pulp Fiction, it's like, do we need it? Of course we do. But at the same time, you're just like, I don't know. But I don't know. There's something about this movie, and just maybe because I'm just a big Uma Thurman fan for most of my life, I was just like connected with her and, you know, the characters. It's funny when it needs to be.
Yeah.
Just has all those like Quentin kind
it's
of like
kind
hallmarks.
Of all of these fun genres working all in one movie.
Yeah. And it does that thing where it's like, I feel like these are things that like that I would do if I were to direct or to produce a movie where at the beginning of the movie, it's like this is in Shaw scope, right? Which is the Shaw Brothers were a production house that made kung fu movies.
I feel like I'm going to a movie at the New Beverly.
Right. Well, that's different. That's like the feature presentation, but that was part of the Shaw Brothers, you know. So certain things that he put in there, to these anachronisms and things like that, I feel like I'm on board with, and I'm like, I would do that just for no reason. Like, this is not a Shaw Brothers production, but it's like that. And there's actors that were used in those movies and character names and things like that are referencing those. So it's like, okay, put it in there. I like it. I like doing all that little kind of, anachronisms, like in my work, referencing like other things. So I think it was really... it's really charming in that sense. I think it's one of the most like Quentin Tarantino air quotes like movies there is. Like we were saying, these music cues.
I was looking up on the internet all of the references in this movie, and it's insane. Like there is a reference to a movie pretty much in every single scene of this movie. And yeah, all of the audio cues are pulled from all of these fun, different areas of pop culture. I mean,
right, but the music cues in this movie have now been like just woven into like pop culture. Mm-hmm. And now it's like when we see Lucy Liu walking down the hallway, walking towards us, is like, is this a Chili's commercial? Maybe. Has it been used to like sell me like tires? I don't know, possibly. But it's like that song is just like overused. Dare I say?
Who's the Japanese girl group that sings that song?
No, that's not the song that I'm talking about.
Oh, Woohoo, the 5678s? Oh,
well, that's not what I'm talking about. No. I'm talking about the Kung Fu Panda song.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then the 5678s have an interesting story. I don't think that they're the tightest band out there. Listening to this performance in this movie, and I'm just like, they are sloppy. But, you know, it's kitschy. The band is kitschy. Like a girl group with beehives and performing in bare feet and they're Japanese singing 60s doo-wop songs.
As the story goes, fun. Tarantino was just in Tokyo and walked into a record store and one of their singles, maybe even the one in the movie, the Woohoo song, was just playing. And Tarantino was just like, who is this band? And just bought the CD straight from the store that was being played. And then they showed up as cameos, as the band playing at the House of the Blue Leaves?
Is it Blue Leaves or Blue Flower or something like that, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Okay, I also think that the idea behind this movie, if when you kind of watch any sort of... See, okay, think about Quentin Tarantino.
We discussed him a little bit on our Switchblade Sisters episode.
I enjoy his work. There are certain movies that I like. There are certain movies that I don't really care about.
Which ones are those? Which ones do you not like?
I've yet to see The Hateful Eight.
The Hateful Eight? Yeah, The Hateful Eight, it's probably one of my least favorites. It's kind of right down there with me with Django Unchained. I think that they're fine.
Right. Never seen Django Unchained. I've only seen the early movies. Mm-hmm. I kind of
stopped.
So
you have never even seen Inglourious Basterds then?
No, I've never seen
it. Because, I mean, Inglourious Basterds was his war epic that he was writing for years. It was the movie that he was writing before Kill Bill.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like World War II movies.
Inglourious Basterds is kind of interesting with the character of the bride because... I think that her name is Shoshana, the character that Melanie Laurent plays. She has a lot of bride characteristics that I think that a lot of that character ended up in the Inglourious Basterds script of just kind of this woman that's kind of kind of driven by revenge. So a lot of Melanie's character beats kind of are taken from The Bride.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have not seen Inglourious Basterds, Django Unchained, or The Hateful Eight, but I have seen Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which I
enjoy. One of my favorites.
Yeah. Yes. But his earlier movies, 1, 2, 3, and Kill Bill Volume 1 and 2, I enjoy a lot. Even Reservoir Dogs, and that was one movie where I was just like, oh, it's so violent. But then you get the whole like, well, actually, all the violence is off screen. All right, I get it. It's still really just like, and this is true of this movie. People were, or movies where people are just like constantly getting beat up and like all that. I'm just like, ugh, this is a lot. Something about Kill Bill Volume 1, it's there and it's heavy and the material is heavy, but I don't know. I just am rooting for Uma the whole time.
Same.
You know? And I mean, there's probably a lot that can be said about Quentin Tarantino as a person. I'm sure he's just as up his own ass as he comes across. But, you know, he makes a great movie. He makes a watchable movie.
Yep.
And it's just like this like Hollywood legend of him and Uma Thurman kind of like dreaming up this movie just like in a conversation.
As they were filming Pulp Fiction, that they sort of came up with this revenge movie kind of in the style of old Grindhouse and Kung Fu movies. And they came up with the character of the bride. And I believe as the story goes, Uma thought, wouldn't it be cool that we're introduced to this character in a wedding dress, beat up on her wedding day. And that's kind of, I mean, it's the opening of this movie.
Yeah, and it's a compelling image, you know. And then you just expand on that. And you get, like, an opportunity for these really great characters.
I always think of Mia Wallace's sitcom that she filmed.
Well, a lot of people are saying it's not a sitcom. Fox Force 5 is not a sitcom.
Fox
Force 5 is an hour-long drama.
Okay.
It's an hour-long cop show. Everybody knows that.
It sounds like you have, like, spec scripts written already.
Well, the thing is, I mean, there's, like, you know, I don't know how apocryphal they are, but there's kind of, like, what am I saying? Urban legends of that Kill Bill and the Deadly Viper Assassination Squad.
The Divas.
Are essentially the plot line of Fox Force 5 that Mia Wallace explains in Pulp Fiction to John Travolta, to Vincent Vega. Yes.
All of the assassins kind of have a little gimmick that they're most known for.
Right. And they'll probably explain it to us in the second part, which we'll watch in a couple of days. But, like, I'm sitting there going, okay, I should have been Black Mamba. I remember that. I should have been Black China. But I'm trying to piece together, like, they're all snake names. I get that.
Mm-hmm.
They're also Copperhead.
The California Mountain Snake.
You know, Black Mamba.
Sidewinder.
Yeah. They're all snakes. Okay. But then she says something to Vivica Fox about, like, you know, using a knife. And she said, like, I should have been Black China. And then she says, like, oh, weapon of choice. I'm like, weapon of choice? What does that mean? Like, Black Mamba. Okay. We're getting ahead of ourselves. I do want to talk a little bit about this cast because there's some really great people in this movie doing some really good work, even if it's for one scene at a time.
Well, we should probably go chronological. Of where the movie opens.
Chronological of the movie.
Of the movie.
Not chronological of the timeline.
Of just kind of where the movie opens and who we're introduced first. Okay, so I remember when I rented this movie and this opening shot in Pasadena, Vernita Green lives just down the street from us probably. I like to think that. but I remember this scene where Uma opens up the door to Vivica A. Fox and that sound drop happens.
Right.
And just, like, being like, oh, my God, I am buckled up and ready to go.
You're like, what the hell am I listening to, first of all? And that's kind of, like, obviously that's a huge, not gimmick, but it's just something that's become part of pop culture. It's in Family Guy. It's here. It's there. But that is from – that's a – reference.
Yeah.
That's from Ironside. I want to say the TV show Ironside, and it says it's by Quincy Jones. Like, okay. And then it just becomes this thing throughout the movie. You know, every time you see somebody in the red light and all that, and it's a lot, and it's jarring.
And you always get the image of them.
Of what she remembers
of her
them.
Lying on the floor and looking up at him.
Right, right. Yep. But it's just like, all of those, and Quentin does this in all of his, in a lot of his movies, maybe not all of them, but it's just these things from his childhood, TV shows that you used to watch, you know, movies, little bits and pieces, throw them in there to like build this like pastiche. And it's, we don't know the reference of Ironside, but people listening go, what is that? That's okay. And it's from a TV show that I remember as a kid. So it's just crazy how all this shit gets thrown into this pot and it creates this. There's Star Trek references in this.
Mm-hmm. What are the Star Trek references?
The opening shot is a Klingon proverb. Revenge is a dish best served cold. I don't know if that was appropriated from someone else. And it's because Star Trek does this thing where Klingons will say something and they'll claim it as being theirs. Like Shakespeare. Like, you haven't lived until you've heard Shakespeare in the original Klingon. And it's like, the original Klingon. So I don't know if revenge is a dish best served cold is actually a Klingon proverb or not, but in the movie, it is credited to them. And then separately, the second Star Trek reference is when we meet Sophie Fatale.
Dressed like a villain on Star Trek.
Dressed like a Star Trek villain. Yes. And that got a big laugh in the theater. Mm-hmm. I'll never forget that. She's just wearing a dress with a Mandarin collar, but, you know, it's all black and satin.
Julie Dreyfus, I only know her from this movie.
Sure, yeah.
I don't think I've ever seen her in anything else. I'm sure that she's worked a lot, but I only know her from Kill Bill as Sophie.
Sure.
Sophie Fatale.
Sophie Fatale.
Oren's lawyer.
And that is Julie Dreyfus, not to be confused with Julia Louis-Dreyfus. So, yeah, it's, you know, going back to the sound drop from Ironside excerpt, Quincy Jones, we both had the soundtrack when it came out. CD.
I remember burning it from the guy that lived next door to me in the dorms.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
Okay.
So it was kind of making the rounds.
Sure.
In college.
Did it do that thing where they had clips of audio
yes.
from the movie?
Yep.
Okay.
It'd be a fun soundtrack to have on vinyl. For
sure.
That very reason.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. More by Bernard Herrmann. Yeah, that was a thing. I mean,
Well, before we get to the Beharn,
I'm looking at the soundtrack now.
Before we get to that, I do want to talk a little bit about Vivica A. Fox. Doesn't have a lot of screen time in this movie,
right.
But I love this character, and I love Vivica A. Fox in this role. I think that these opening scenes, this fight scene, is so fucking rad.
I love Vivica A. Fox in everything, first
yeah.
of all. I love her in her auto insurance commercials.
Oh, super fierce.
How'd it happen?
She showed up dead on arrival.
This never gets easier.
It does when you call CarShield before your car breaks down. Look at these prices. The camshaft, transmission, engine.
Don't people know? A plan through CarShield could protect up to 5,000 parts and systems.
You hate to see it.
An out-of-warranty car is going to break down eventually.
Right, which is why they need a plan through CarShield. Those expensive repair bills get paid and at the mechanic of their choice. They're notifying the family.
Poor guy. He doesn't even know what's coming.
Another victim of senselessly expensive repair bills.
Her Instagram's kind of amazing. Go follow her. She needs more followers.
Wasn't her big thing was like managing male strippers for a while?
She did a like a Black People Magic Mike.
Magic Mike, yep.
Yeah, she
love
did that,
it.
And I think she produced that, which, you know, maybe she's still making some coin from that. But yeah, she's doing these auto insurance commercials with Ice-T. And when they do them like a cop procedural, so good. Love it. But yeah, Vivica is just like so fierce.
Vernita Green, codenamed Copperhead, the former yes. Deadly Viper, and she now lives in Pasadena under the name Jeannie Bell.
Married to the good Dr. Bell.
And especially how like this opening sequence when Uma Thurman just pulls up in the pussy wagon and
right.
you don't really have a context for it.
Right.
And you're just like, what the hell am I watching? And then proceed to kick the shit out of each other and break all the furniture in this living room.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It's like, what an opening scene.
You know that no good dog of yours? He got in here and acted a damn fool.
And then just kind of like the subtle things that when you revisit this movie later, when she's fixing the cereal, mm-hmm. when she's making the cereal, mm-hmm. kaboom.
Yeah.
On the box. Right. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Well, Quentin has fake brands
yeah.
that he uses in all of his movies, like the Green Apple cigarettes, which there's a huge billboard for Green Apple cigarettes in this movie.
Kahuna Burger.
And oh, who yeah, is on the billboard for Green Apple cigarettes? It's Julie Dreyfus. So she's not only Oren Ishii's
spokeslawyer,
she is a model.
Spokeswoman and a model.
Spokeswoman for Green yep. Apple cigarettes. Yeah, the opening, that's the thing. It's not really like an opening of this movie because there's scenes before it. Mm-hmm. You know, there's this scene in the church in El Paso with the cops and the dead bodies all over the floor. And then it cuts to the credits. And then, you know, it takes a minute. Like, to me, in my brain, I'm just like, well, movie get, opens well, and I the mean, door opens.
Well,
and
you get, well, I mean, the opening of the scene is Bill and the Bride.
And right,
then it,
right.
And then it goes to credits, yeah.
Right, but that's what I'm saying. It's like mm-hmm. it doesn't immediately go to, you know, to
yeah, I,
to
I guess
fight.
I guess that when I meant for like opening
no, no,
scene,
no,
I
no,
meant
I,
like the in like
right. No, I absolutely know what you mean, but I'm just yeah. saying like in your head it goes to that, mm-hmm. but this movie is so like it's like segmented into these little sections, but it's still like flows and has like a good like I don't know you're never lost, you're just like all right.
It's a pretty tight movie. I mean, we just finished it and I hit pause to I think probably go grab a drink or something, and it was 40 minutes in and I feel like we had only been watching 20 minutes of the movie.
Right.
So yeah, like the pacing is really well done. Sally Menke, I believe that she's been working with him for most of his career. She definitely edited Pulp Fiction.
Okay.
So yeah, he kind of works with the same female editor for all of these movies.
In this scene, was the first time that the bride's name is bleeped out. Why?
Yeah, why? It just kind of adds a weird layer at least
mystery.
To the first movie.
There's mystery there that you're like, what the fuck is her name?
And then it just kind of pays off when
you finally find out
in volume two.
And then you hear yeah. it and you're like, that's her name. Mm-hmm. What's that about? what kind of name is that? But it's that thing where, especially kind of when you know there's going to be a sequel, you're very much like, I must know now.
That's, yeah, and that's what I think is really interesting about the production history.
I do want to talk a little bit about that because I do remember just hearing like, okay, and this is, so probably now 2002, mm-hmm. right? So think
as
back.
They,
get in
they
your
were
way back
it.
Machine,
yep.
mm-hmm. and we're going to go back to 2002 before anybody knew. It wasn't didn't even have a release title yet. All I knew is that Quentin Tarantino is shooting a kung fu movie in China. Mm-hmm. And I was like, fuck, China. And they were talking about it on K-Rock. And I was just like listening to, you know, the radio in the evening at home. And like the DJ was just like, you know, not breaking news, but you know, just like Quentin Tarantino's in Hollywood.
Yep.
He's shooting this movie. It's they're all the way in China. They went all the way over there to shoot this kung fu movie. And they were like, wow, if he went to China to like to shoot a kung fu movie, then it's like this is like the real deal. Like he's gonna get like real like, you know, kung fu experts on it. And he did, you know. And I was just like, holy shit, that sounds crazy. Like, what is this movie gonna be? You know, it had no title, had no anything. I don't even know if they said that Uma Thurman was gonna be in it, but it was just like, okay, whatever it is, I'm in, because this seems epic if they're, you know, going all that like to make this.
I remember first reading about the production of this movie in Premiere magazine. I can't remember if I would have read about his war movie. I mean, it ended up being Inglourious Basterds in 2009
okay.
because that was sort of in pre-production before Kill Bill. And then for some reason, they circled back to this idea that he had with Uma, and they ended up making this before Inglourious Basterds.
Right.
So there is a trailer online, which would have been an early cut trailer of this. I don't know if it was leaked online. I think it was. That it is both movies cut together. That maybe this was done early 2003 when Miramax was unsure if this was going to be a 4-hour single film. there's a version of the trailer with scenes from both Volume 1 and Volume 2 because the fight scene with L. Driver is in the trailer.
Right.
And there's also some Michael Madsen stuff. So I don't really know of just sort of...
I think it was a last-minute thing. I feel like I remember it being a thing where they're just like, this movie's too crazy and Quentin wants to include as much as he can. Mm-hmm. And so we're going to do two movies rather than cutting out, you know... important shit.
And probably when watching that first cut, that first 4-hour cut of the movie, probably just kind of seeing the tone difference between both halves. And this can almost work in our favor to kind of cut two different versions of this movie in Volume 1 and Volume 2. And it can work.
Right. I mean, I feel like if they had just made like a 3-hour movie... I think the tonal shifts would still be there, but I think we would have lost a lot of really interesting story. You know, I think in this one, in this movie, a lot of time is spent on Lucy Liu's character.
Yeah.
a full 15-minute anime sequence.
I'm surprised that the Weinsteins didn't make him cut that, which made me think that, oh, like Quentin must have had first cut on that, or like final cut on this. That the anime sequence was staying in.
Yeah, I think if anything, they would have allowed him to have the last word on the cut of the movie because just his name alone in the late 90s, early 2000s was just like auteur.
Yeah, and it just...
He is our last new hope for like, you know, high quality, like Hollywood cinema. He's like Quentin Tarantino.
Well, I mean, his... movies and his brand definitely helped build Miramax as a studio, too.
Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's references to Pulp Fiction in this movie, too, which I thought was interesting. Square.
Oh, sure. That's Square.
We'll be about Square. Yeah. I think this movie was, like, legendary leading up to it. And, yeah, I think... Is it just like a badass lady villain or not villain, lady like hero, like ass kicking like
Mama Slay.
You miss Mama Slay. Mm-hmm. We're just here to watch Mama Slay.
Big reason why we're covering it. I mean, there's reasons why the gays and straight men can agree on at least one Tarantino movie, and it's probably Kill Bill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, although I have to say, I feel like a lot of straight guys I know are not like, oh yeah, Uma Thurman.
Yeah, probably. I mean, I've talked on the podcast of how obsessed I was with Uma Thurman on the show.
Right, yeah. But I feel like for like straight guys, I don't know. I feel like I've heard like man hands or like she's too tall or like stuff like that. Like, okay. But she is the classic example of Tyra Banks and Nigel, what was his name? Nigel Barker saying that the, you know, you just have like quirkiness in your face and you shouldn't be attractive, but you are. And like, you know what I mean? What mm-hmm. would she say? Well, she would say something like that. Like,
yeah, I mean, she's unusual looking and that's what makes her unique.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I think she looks like a fashion model. She's pretty like fashion models are pretty in that way that it's like it's not conventionally like classically beautiful. I mean, unless you're like Brooke Shields or Christie Brinkley, but she just has that thing that like like a couture model would have.
It's kind of something. That shape of the face, which is a little more oval.
Well, not even that. It's just the fact that like her nose is too big, and like I don't know, her eyes are too wide set apart. Like things that are considered like flaws.
Yeah.
Right. Not necessarily just like her features, but just like what's things that would be considered wrong with her features, right? And like I said, like I've heard people say like, oh, you got man hands, really big hands. It's like, yeah, because I think she's like 5'11 or something, like 5'10 and a half. Like, but I think she's still pretty like widely, you know, liked, right? I don't think there's like Uma haters out there. I'm not saying straight guys are like, she's gross. I just don't think that they're like, oh, yeah, she's super hot.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk a little bit about Vernita Green. We love Vivica Fox.
Mm-hmm.
As we've stated in this movie, again, we haven't gotten any backstory. All we get is this fight, right? And it's like, I don't know. We had already gotten The Matrix. So Kung Fu, we're here for it. Charlie's Angels, wire work, all that. But this wasn't that.
Really aggressive.
They're throwing at each other around this living room. This was like a street fight. And I feel like not having score and just having like them like the grunting noises and just like glass breaking. It was like, oh, shit.
I mean, I'm trying to
think of it was different.
Trying to think of something that was sort of similar in mainstream Hollywood movies, and maybe The Bourne Identity, which was out in 2002, kind of had fights like this.
It was. That's another one that I've never seen.
Oh, okay.
I was never...
But yeah.
Never but
The Bourne Identity's like fight sequences are very like physical and aggressive and shit like this.
Yeah, things where it's like the like punches and those like hard like hardcore like punching noises and people like I've seen Bourne Identity like fights. I'm like, okay, this is interesting. But yeah, something like this hadn't been seen, and then also two women, you know, fighting like this. There's a thing I was reading something about, like, in movies and, like, action movies or whatever, headshots, like, people getting shot in the head.
Yeah.
Like, you see it in movies and it's, like, it's a thing. But you don't – there's, like, a really, 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 really low number of women in film getting shot in the head.
And yeah, and Vernita Green gets
– well, she gets stabbed in the chest. Yeah. But the bride gets shot in the head in this movie. The very beginning.
Sure. Of how we're introduced to her.
Yeah, that's crazy. But yeah, and the way that, she gets stabbed, like, all that shit is just like, this fight scene is like, it's intense.
Yeah, it's gnarly.
Yeah, so it's like nothing that I had seen. And I was already, like, in my early 20s at that point. I was like, you know. So, and again, I watched a lot of horror movies. So I know from, like, death scenes, but still, horror movies are always stylized, and this is stylized but in a different way. But yeah, it really kind of sets you up for like, okay, this is the movie that we're watching now.
Yeah, this is the crazy movie that you've been thrown into. I mean, this opening sequence, they're still talking about Vivica A. Fox's daughter.
If
Volume 3 is actually going to happen.
Okay. So then, okay. And I remember, as a kid, when I first watched this movie, as a kid in my early 20s, I remember her saying that to this little girl.
When you grow up, and if you're still sore about it, I'll be waiting. Yep.
And I'm like, okay, this kid's supposed to be 4. We're going to do another one in 20 years? Here we are.
Here we are 20 years later.
YouTube clickbait videos starring Zendaya.
A full poster mock-up of Zendaya that I saw... on
YouTube,
multiple websites.
YouTube clickbait thumbnails do not take much. This is Canva and nothing. So, but yeah, I've seen that one for a while on YouTube. Is there real talk about it?
I don't think that there's anything serious. I mean,
are Q and U like getting together over a box of wine and like magazines?
I mean, he's about to start production on his 10th movie, which is
his final movie,
The Movie Critic. Yep. The film critic, the movie critic, I can't remember the title.
But it's like his 10th and final movie. He made that rule up.
Mm-hmm. It's completely arbitrary. I still don't completely buy that this might be his final movie.
But I'm saying it's like it's completely arbitrary.
Yeah.
It's just one of those grand, stupid, kind of corny ideas that like only Quentin Tarantino can come up with and be like, when I become a director, I'm only gonna make 10. I'm gonna say at the very beginning, I'm going into Scorsese there. But I don't know if it'll be his last one. I didn't even know it had a title or what it's about.
Tom Cruise allegedly is supposed to be in it.
Tom Cruise?
Yep.
Tommy, can you hear me? Well, that's exciting.
We'll see if Tommy can get his Oscar. his legacy Oscar for his Tom Cruise movie.
I don't know. Yep. I don't want to see Tom Cruise win an Oscar. I thought I'd never see the day.
All right, so I want to talk. I mean, we've been going through a big Daryl Hannah era on the podcast.
Yes,
so we're back here again talking about Daryl. I think she is so much fun in these hospital scenes.
Oh, and you don't owe her shit.
You don't owe her shit. You thought that was pretty fucking funny, didn't you? So good. And, you know, it took me until the last viewing to figure out the costume.
Oh, yeah.
Of the nurse's uniform with the Sharpie on it.
Espy called that out years ago. She was like, that shit was so cool.
That I
was
is like, so it. Clever. Like, that little subtle piece of costume design that, I mean, it took me almost 20 years to figure that out.
Right, right. Yep. So she's wearing a trench coat, and it's white, but all the details in the trench coat are drawn in with what looks like Sharpie. Mm-hmm. And down to, like, stitching, down to stitches are, like, drawn in completely. A belt, buttons,
of it. I like to picture Elle Driver in her trailer just kind of making this nurse uniform.
But, that's like a real, like, nurse costume. This is her disguise when she walks in.
But like, but she was making her disguise with the Sharpie.
Right. Yep. But it's very interesting that, like, this jacket has a belt and buttons drawn on. And she's wearing it closed as if it's fastened by buttons. So this jacket has got to be an interesting piece of clothing to wear. Because any notions, as Tim Gunn would call them, any notions, fasteners, buttons, zippers, all that stuff are completely hidden on the outside. And so it's flat, but all this shit is drawn on. And I remember my good friend Espy, friend of the pod, Romeo and Juliet and Virgin Suicides, she pointed that out when this movie came out on DVD. She's like, did you buy Kill Bill yet? And I was like, yes, I bought it. And she's like, I watched it. It was grainy. I was like, interesting. But yeah, she points it out. She's like, did you notice Elle Driver's like trench coat is like all the details are drawn in. And I always noticed it after that, but that's funny that you didn't caught that. Yeah.
I mean,
it on our little TVs.
And also like when I was 17 years old and I watched this, I wouldn't have got the Dress to Kill reference
of the
split screen and the De Palma. Like that would have gone right over my head. But like now that I've watched a little more movies that I can catch stuff like that. And we have talked about the Grindhouse movie Switchblade Sisters, which the character of
Patch
is, I mean, it's pretty much Elle Driver that he was pulling from. Yep.
He's pulling from Patch to create Elle Driver. But everybody is, it's all pastiche in this movie.
Yeah.
It's wonderful. But yeah, and you know, when you think about Uma Thurman, I kind of talked about it a little bit before. She's tall, she's model-esque, she's statuesque, all that stuff. And Daryl Hannah is kind of, I mean, even though she's also blonde, kind of a good foil, because I feel like Daryl Hannah has kind of a reputation of like modeling background, tall, statuesque. So I was like, okay, that's a good like one-to-one for Uma or for the bride. But the Elle Driver character is fierce.
I think,
and so fucking
funny. I think that both of Elle and the bride's relationships to Bill off screen are very interesting. Just how they both play the scenes.
Right.
It's like, was he dating the bride and then now
bride and Bill were together romantically. But I think that Elle Driver was probably jealous of that at the time, and then if they are romantically entangled now, is just like, well, fuck that bitch, you know, his ex or whatever. So yeah, that it's very interesting. First of all, I haven't even mentioned it. We are going to talk about Bill. We have to talk about Bill. Casting is wild. This character is insane. I don't even know where to start.
Just done, sort of in silhouette and in voiceover in this movie too.
Right. Yeah. Right.
David Carradine, not Keith Carradine. David Carradine.
Keith Carradine is from Revenge of the Nerds.
Yeah.
But it's his brother.
Mm-hmm.
But this is David. And I believe his daughter is an actress.
Isn't it Martha Plimpton?
No. Yes.
Isn't Martha Plimpton like one of the Carradines' daughter?
Yes. Yes. David Carradine is the father of Martha Plimpton and Ever Carradine. Both actresses, Martha Plimpton, friend of the pod. We love you. Come on the show anytime. But I'd feel like I found out that Martha Plimpton is David Carradine's daughter like 5 years ago. Like, I feel like I didn't know that my entire life. But they're an acting dynasty, the Carradine family. Mm-hmm.
I was reading that the role was written for Warren Beatty and he passed.
Not Bert.
Yeah.
I don't know that Burt would have been right for this.
Maybe Pat maybe offered to Burt, but yeah, it was the idea was Warren Beatty, which I could see. I think that David Carradine is kind of more suited to this character.
Right. Especially that's what I'm saying.
Especially with the voice.
Yeah. And but also David Carradine. Okay. If we're gonna go into it. I want to talk a little bit about David Carradine in the 70s. Was on a TV show called Kung Fu.
Mm-hmm.
And he played a Chinese guy.
Sure. Yeah. 70s.
And different times. There's a bit in Margaret Cho's stand-up talking about Asian representation in the 70s and the 80s and how if it was there, it was either wrong or bad or still racist. So, and she remembered the show Kung Fu, and she said they should have renamed it. The show should have been called That Guy's Not Chinese! So, every time I see David Carradine, I always want to say, That guy's not Chinese! Because he's not. But he was walking there solving mysteries and using kung fu. But that's a big reason for Quentin to say, like, hey, this yeah. guy's right for this role. But also, David Carradine, and I don't know if I'm just conflating the character of Bill and him, but I think I'm right. David Carradine is that kind of, like, kooky white guy that's a little like Psycho Billy and like wears a lot of jewelry, possibly turquoise. It's like he can like ride a motorcycle and he can like carve, you know, like whittle like a duck or something. And like he's just very, you know, like he may have leather chaps, but he doesn't really only wears them like on the Harley.
I mean, Google is death.
Well, this yep. is what I'm saying, mm-hmm. you know? There's, like, fringe involved, but I'm talking about clothing, not, like, other things. And I just feel like he's that kind of, like, very Sedona, Arizona, just, like, kind of...
Sure. No, I know exactly what you're talking right? about. Yeah.
And if you know what I'm talking about, you know exactly what I mean. But there's parts of Bill that I'm just like, is he supposed to be a white guy? Because I don't know. Like in Oren's backstory, in the anime backstory, I was like, that's Bill?
Well, I almost think with the animation, I think that Quentin just handed off right, the right, characters right. to the studio and they just did whatever they wanted to.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, and then also, listeners, neither Scott nor I are experts in the following areas. Anime.
Yeah, I'm a noob. I've seen the major Miyazaki movies, and right. that's it.
Kung Fu movies, samurai swords,
yeah,
Japanese or Chinese culture. This movie is more focused on Japanese culture, and I feel like the second movie is a little bit more Chinese kind of folklore with the characters
mm-hmm.
in the second movie. That the Pai Mei and the long white beard yeah. and all that stuff. But neither of us are experts in either of those
not
cultures. We appreciate what we're seeing in this movie, and we'll try to respectfully kind of like explain any of that stuff that we as viewers can, you know, take in. But I'm just saying, David Carradine's not Chinese. Mm-hmm. But I feel like he's also the kind of guy that would tell you that like he could play any role kind of
sure.
kind of thing.
Well,
whatever Bill needs sure. to be. If you think he's Japanese... And, you know, and can fight with a samurai sword. If you think he's, whatever. If you think he's just a Sedona, Arizona kind of fringe jacket kind of guy with turquoise jewelry, he's all of it.
I want to go back to the hospital scene again.
Yes,
I mean,
let's do that.
We got to talk about Twisted Nerve.
Oh, my God.
Of how fucking weird is that?
Okay.
I mean, here's the thing about this. This audio grab is yeah. from a Hayley Mills movie from England
right.
called Twisted Nerve that was so controversial at the time when it came out in the is it late 60s or early 70s?
Early 70s, like 70,
early 70s,
I think.
Like 71 or something. Yeah. 1970. It may even be late 60s. I don't remember. So controversial, pulled from its release in America
right.
and has never officially been given a home video release ever. You need to get bootlegs right. or you need to get an old print of it. And Tarantino is one of those hardcore movie nerds that he has a print of Twisted Nerve with the song in it.
Right.
Or like with this piece of score in it. And it's done by Bernard Herrmann,
right,
who most famously did Psycho.
And Vertigo.
And Vertigo.
And
yep.
At this time in 2003...
Nobody would have known that.
No, but I... Not saying I would have known it. I'm saying I had already gone to San Francisco and did my Vertigo sightseeing tour. I was a huge... I owned Psycho on VHS at the time. You know, so I knew who Bernard Herrmann was. I have this soundtrack on CD, as you said you did as well. And I would see it. I would see Twisted Nerve, Bernard Herrmann, and just thinking, well, it must be for some movie, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
But, like, without IMDb in my pocket, I never really did my due diligence to figure out what the hell
and
Twisted
yeah,
Nerve
and,
was.
And like I mentioned, that Twisted Nerve was so hated at the time yeah. that it was immediately buried.
Right.
So it's
right.
just like...
so, and that's the thing. I was yep. just like, I guess that's... I guess it, Bernard Herrmann writes for movies, so it must be a movie, yet I've never heard of it. No one knows what it is. And yeah, so I just kind of never really thought twice about it because we didn't really have the access that we do now to be like, what the hell is Twisted Nerve? Let's look it up and go see it at the New Beverly.
And now it's like the legacy of Twisted Nerve right. is not from the movie... it's from the scene
from
of Kill
this,
Bill,
yes.
which
yeah.
is really interesting.
Yeah.
So a couple years ago, I think like a year and a half ago, they showed a print of Twisted Nerve at the New Beverly, which is mm-hmm. actually, I mean, it's the Quentin Tarantino-owned movie theater in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. It's on Beverly Boulevard in L.A., and they showed Twisted Nerve. And I saw it on the schedule, and I was like, oh, shit. I want to go see this.
Yeah.
So we went to it with friend of the pod, Michael Morgan, and our friend Marlene. Both have done episodes. Mm-hmm. Twisted Nerve, wild. What did you think of it when we watched it in the movie theater?
Yeah, it was crazy. I was like, okay, Haley Mills. I only know her as child Haley Mills or Miss Bliss. So it was very interesting
yeah.
to kind of see
you kind
her.
Of see her
as like a teenager, or
a,
like
young,
a
adult.
Young adult.
She's like yeah. she's college age in the movie.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, Twisted Nerve is kind
cuckoo.
Of is pretty cuckoo. I mean, not politically correct at all.
No.
With I mean, various elements of that movie. But yeah, it's a trip.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But I can also see. Let's say it was released in the States. I could see it being just as obscure because it is very British. It's not like,
yeah.
I don't know. It doesn't feel like an American movie even for the time. So I feel like it would be kind of along the lines of those, what's that, like Hush Sweet Alice or something? It's
yeah.
like, it's there. Like, oh, it's probably on Tubi or something. Like, you can watch it if you want to, but it's kind of funky. Yeah, I feel like... American audiences might have just been like, this is weird. But yeah, I really just remember it being the vibe because it's just that very like swinging London kind of feeling.
Mm-hmm. It's really interesting to see how it's used in the movie. I mean, it's used yeah. throughout in the movie. I mean, yes, when you have a piece of score
lot,
like
yeah.
this, it is called back numerous times.
Yeah.
So Twisted Nerve, I mean, it's probably available online somewhere to watch. Like, you can probably do some sort of a digging and find it.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, that soundbite, that was, you know, people's...
ringtones.
Ringtones on
yep.
their phone. Like, you know, it just became this thing that it was this cultural, like, moment that everybody was just like, oh, fuck yeah, man, Kill Bill. And so on all these sound cues, there's just something so genius about Quentin and his ability to... include these little moments that just enhance these scenes and become these earworms that everybody's just like, fuck yeah, I know it now. That's from Kill Bill. It's no longer part of what it was part
no,
of before.
Not at all.
It's
yep.
just Kill Bill now. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just, and it's the same thing for that Ironside Quincy Jones song when she sees people for the first time. Mm-hmm. You know, they're just. It'll forever, well, not forever, but for now, it's those are Kill Bill moments. They've lost their original,
yeah,
you know, their origin story. But yeah, I feel like I thought that the Daryl Hannah stuff was really funny. Mm-hmm. When I first saw it, I just thought she was just playing this character.
You wanted
this
more
insane
of her
character,
yep. mm-hmm.
and she's just so pissed. She's just so fucking pissed.
I remember when, I think that it was during the MTV Movie Awards when she accepted Best Fight, that she dedicated her...
Oh, so she won.
She dedicated... This was for Volume 2.
Okay.
That she dedicated her golden popcorn to Margaret Hamilton because The Wicked Witch of the West was like a big inspiration for L Driver, which I love. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's funny. And, you know, it's beautiful Daryl Hannah, and she's in this very stylized nurse's outfit, but she's got an eye patch.
Mm-hmm.
Like, okay. Why does she have an eye patch? We'll find out in the sequel.
Yeah, that, you know, that image of her with the eye patch and that blonde hair is very cunt. I love it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
All of these scenes when the bride goes to Okinawa, I think that Uma is so beautiful in all of these scenes.
Yeah,
of her in this white T-shirt and that cool graphic on the hair. Her hair is up in like the
graphic on the T-shirt.
Yeah, the graphic on the T-shirt. Her hair is up in that cute little pony. And how great is Sonny Chiba in this role? I think he's so good.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
I love these scenes.
And that's the thing, too. Sonny Chiba is like a prolific actor in Asia. Probably has, you know, countless credits on his IMDb, but, mm-hmm. you know, not a big name.
I think
he passed away
fairly recently, too.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
But that's just a pull from Quentin to bring people in from these movies that, you know, that he loved or whatever. So, but yeah, he plays that role really well of this, like, sword maker turned like secret sushi chef.
Sword maker who has kind of left the business.
Right.
He doesn't like that all of these weapons can do all of this harm, that he's gone to like just live in Okinawa and make sushi.
Right.
And drink sake.
Yep. And there's an interesting language that this movie has, aside from the musical language and the visual language, but there are things in the movie that... this isn't our reality, and there are rules in this reality that are different than ours. Like the bride flying from the United States to Okinawa with a samurai sword.
Yeah. Definitely doesn't live in a 9/11 world.
doesn't live in any world, mm-hmm. you know? But a world where people can carry swords freely on a plane, and then there's this underworld that they live in where if you go to this sword maker and you even know who he is,
yeah,
and you're an American woman, but if you speak the language and, you know, then he's like, well, fuck, I guess I gotta make
Well, she knew that when she dropped the Bill. Name of one of his students, mm-hmm. Bill, that he had to do it.
Right, mm-hmm. right. But yeah, that this underworld like exists. Yeah, it's very precise, and there's just like so much backstory like built in that's you just forget about it because it's so well like woven through the story.
It's,
like,
it's
oh,
pretty
okay,
immersive.
I get it. This is the world we're in. This is the language that this movie's speaking right now.
So kind of going into the later half of this movie, which is probably fully the last 50 minutes of this movie,
uh-huh.
is when she lands in Tokyo. All right. of those really cool model shots of Tokyo,
yes.
I was reading, were from a Godzilla movie that they repurposed. I thought that was really cool. We always comment when we're driving in the downtown, if we're going to Precinct or something, the shot of the tunnel is in Los Angeles.
Right. Well, yeah. It's the big famous tunnel.
It's the big famous tunnel.
Blade Runner.
In movies.
And,
yeah.
You know.
So yeah, so we always think of Kill Bill whenever we're about to drive through this tunnel.
Mm-hmm.
We have not seen a motorcyclist yet.
I don't even like going through the tunnel.
In a yellow.
It looks so sad now.
In a yellow suit. Yeah, it is looking pretty sad. But yeah, the showdown of the House of the Blue Leaves. I mean, what a set piece of this movie is all of these scenes. Okay.
Right.
And this leads us to Lucy Liu.
Right.
Cottonmouth. Oren Ishii.
Mm-hmm.
Lucy Liu. So much fun in this movie, and I think that as the story goes, that Quentin was intending to, of course, cast a Japanese actress as the role of Oren Ishii,
mm-hmm.
but he saw her in Shanghai Noon and decided...
Not Shanghai Noon.
Yeah, it was Shanghai Noon. Like, I really want to work with her, so I'm going to write her into the script that she is half Chinese and half Japanese and half American.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. Well, the her father is a Chinese American, like GI.
Yeah,
and her mother's a Japanese woman. So, mm-hmm. yeah, that's an interesting beat. And it's like, yeah, if it wasn't Lucy Liu or a Chinese actress, it wouldn't have even been in there. But Lucy's so good in everything. Like, yeah. I've always just been like, fuck, yes.
I think this
like,
is probably
so cool.
I think this is probably my favorite Lucy Liu performance, I think. I mean, you were talking about just kind of the crazy world that this movie inhabits.
Right.
And I think that the Tokyo crime world is just kind of added to that.
Right.
That
right.
This is a whole layer of this kind of crime society that they're so powerful that they just exist in, like, plain daylight. And
right,
you
right.
know that they're untouchable because she is that powerful in that kind of crime underworld.
Right. And,
yeah.
that's another thing, listeners, children, we're not experts on the Yakuza or the goings-on in the Japanese underworld. But because I know that that's, like, culturally, like, a big, like, kind of, it's like the mafia, right?
Yeah.
But it's, you know, it's in the country. But yeah, and then, yeah, going to this whatever the House of Blue Leaves is, restaurant, club.
Nightclub, yeah, I don't really know.
They got bottle service mm-hmm. and a room and all of these men that she just has at her disposal because obviously she's ahead of, like, the entire Japanese mafia. So she
how,
has unlimited, like, resources.
How fucking rad is that scene where she cuts off his head? I mean, I think it's probably my favorite scene of the movie. Of when she, like, runs across that table and slices off his head. And
right.
she tells him in Japanese, I'm going to say this in English so you really know how serious I am. And she has her whole little monologue.
Right.
It's so good.
That's translated by one Miss Sophie Fétan.
Mm-hmm.
As your leader, I encourage you from time to time, and always in a respectful manner, to question my logic. If you're unconvinced a particular plan of action I've decided is the wisest, tell me so. But allow me to convince you, and I promise you right here and now, no subject will ever be taboo. Except, of course, the subject that was just under discussion. The price you pay for bringing up either my Chinese or American heritage as a negative is, I collect your fucking head. Just like this fucker here.
このファック野郎と同じようにね。
Now, if any of you sons of bitches got anything else to say, now's the fucking time! I didn't think so.
Something about Sophie Fatale and that character, you're just like, ooh, this bitch. Just the fact that she's so, like, doesn't care about anything that's going on.
She's on her cell phone,
like,
in the church.
Who the yep. fuck mm-hmm. do you think? She's not just on her cell phone in church. She's on her cell phone in the church that they're murdering
yep.
a woman in.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Yes. Yeah, so I'm just like, who the hell does this bitch think she is? So it is very vindicating when what happens to her later happens to her. But, yeah, this scene is a good, like, it's the entire third act of the movie. You're just like, okay, this character must
took
be
them,
special.
Probably took them over a month to shoot.
Yeah, who knows? I wouldn't even.
To block and
yeah,
film all
even,
these scenes. I
mean,
these action sequences are so famous that Uma's stunt double just became a household name with movie fans.
Oh, you're talking about Zoe Bell.
Zoe Bell, yep, that went on to be in Death Proof, where she's like a major supporting character, and she has a cute little scene in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood where she's the wife of one of the stunt guys played by Kurt Russell. So it's like she went on to have a working relationship with
right.
Quentin Tarantino. And how cool is that, that a stunt double was able to kind of get that sort of recognition? I mean, you don't really see that a lot in action movies, that, like, nobody knows who Vin Diesel's stunt double is in any of the Fast and the Furious movies,
right?
But you know who the bride's stunt double is because all of those scenes are so impressive that she just kind of became a legend because of all of this.
Right Yeah, I'm watching a lot of the sequence in the House of Blue Flowers and I'm like trying to pick her out. I'm like, that's Zoe. And not because of her face. Her face is obscured in a lot of it. The edit is really
Yeah, it's
really
it's
well
a pretty tight
done
scene.
Because her face is whenever it's clearly well. I don't, and that's the thing. I don't even think it's clearly someone else because I think that's how good Uma is.
Yeah,
that's how good the match is with Zoe, and that's how good she is that she's able to convince you, the viewer, that you're watching
Uma,
someone else. Yeah. Yeah. Scenes that I would think, well, that's probably her. Her hair would be in her face or something so that there's no, like, dead giveaway. I don't think there's any shots where you're just like, well, that's clearly not Uma Thurman.
Mm-hmm.
I think they did a really, really good job with that. But yeah, this is the fight scene that my brother was like, all right.
It's taken to, like, a ludicrous level.
It's getting to like yeah. Peter Jackson, like brain dead type of violence where I'm just like, oh, all right, I need to sit down.
Mm-hmm. The black and white sequences I know were put in just to avoid an NC-17 rating. And I think it kind of works thematically that
right.
It cuts to black and white and you do those cool color scenes in the room upstairs. Like that's all done to kind of dance around like the NC-17 rating, but you know what? It works.
Right.
Yeah. And I'm sure it works as some sort of a reference to a movie too.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that was what they would do in like those movies. I think that was an old trick that they did, was just cut to black and white for no reason. No reason thematically in the movie. So I think it actually might be a reference, or at least started off as one.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting because the fight just goes in these waves. In each way, it's like a video game, you know, until you get to your final boss.
Okay, so I'm reading the black and white photography and the crazy 88 fight sequence is an homage to the 70s and 80s U.S. television airings of kung fu movies where black and white as well as black and white and red were used to conceal the shedding of blood from television censors. Originally, no black and white photographic effects were going to be used, and in the Japanese version, none are, but the MPA demanded more measures to be taken to tone the scene down. Tarantino used an old trick, and its intended purpose was just as an homage. So they used to do that for television airings. That's really interesting.
Yeah, I feel like I read that somewhere in the trivia before. I think that the trailer that we got at Blockbuster was all in color.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah. I remember looking at it and then seeing the movie going, what? I remember watching the trailer at Blockbuster because I had seen it already. And I remembered it specifically. So it must have been me going, doesn't this go to black and white at this point?
Mm-hmm.
But trailers are cut from dailies. Trailers are cut from
working prints.
Work prints. Mm-hmm. So stuff ends up in the trailers. Sometimes that doesn't end up in the movies. Probably not much in a Tarantino movie, in a lesser director. But I feel like the character of Gogo Yubari started a Halloween costume. If you got a schoolgirl look, add yourself a ball and chain.
Yeah.
Boom.
And this actress was from Battle Royale, too. I believe so, yeah.
Yeah.
And it kind of led to her getting this role because Quentin was a big Battle Royale fan.
Right.
All the go-go scenes were really fun. I remember all of us really loving all of that with the ball and chain, really fun fight sequence.
Yeah, and she had her little, like, miniature sword, and it had... It had those there's a name for them. I can't think of them right now. I'm thinking like Pandora charms. But, you know, these little things that like you can get for your cell phone that go like in the case and they dangle from like the corner of your cell phone. But you get them in like a Sanrio store. They're very like kawaii.
Mm-hmm.
And so Gogo's sword was like, it was like kawaii. Like she had like the little like dangly like, you know, keychain type of things, like probably from Sanrio, but just like built into her, like the case of her sword or the hilt, I think it was. And Oren's sword has cherry blossoms on it, like it has flowers on it, right?
Yeah.
So it's like, it's this culture where it's like, are you going to get yourself a sword? And it's just part of like, it's like something that you carry with you every day, like your cell phone. So it's like we decorate our cell phone cases and stuff. So their swords were kind of like indicative of their character.
I don't think I ever noticed that.
Didn't?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a thing. Mm-hmm. And why wouldn't it be, you know? Yeah, I love going into the Sanrio store. Can I tell you that when we were kids, we would go to the Sanrio store. This is the Hello Kitty store, listeners, if you're not familiar. Because mm-hmm. They would always be in every mall. And my mom was a big mall shopper, so we were always at the mall.
I mean, they never would have a Sanrio store in any of the malls that I grew up going to.
The one at the mall that we went to a lot, at the Arcadia Mall in San Anita Mall, it's called Sanrio Surprise. The store is called Sanrio Surprise. And it's just all the Hello Kitty stuff. And my sister loved Hello Kitty. And so when we're little, like little, like I'm like in kindergarten and first grade, and my mm-hmm. sister's in like third grade.
To get like a pencil box,
so it'd be
or
like
something.
A treat to yeah. go and buy something, because they also had cheap stuff. Like you could get like a pencil, you know.
Yeah,
and it just has like whatever character you like. And my sister liked Little Twin Stars, and there were a boy and a girl, and their name were Kiki and Lala, and they were twin siblings. And the boy had blue hair, and the girl had pink hair. And so we'd go a lot. But they would their bag that they would give you stuff in, like the bag, was paper. And it was completely covered in, like, Sanrio characters. And so my mom would take the bags, and she would use them to cover my sister's school books.
Okay, sure.
Right? Cool. And I really wanted a Sanrio bag book cover. And so she covered one of my books in it. Like, we had an extra bag, so my mom covered my book or she gave it to me to cover a book. And this is, like, the first grade. I was like, I want, like, a Hello Kitty store book cover. So my mom was like, okay. I don't remember what book it was. But, I mean, it was the first grade, so nobody really said anything, but I was just like, work.
Here's my Hello Kitty covered book.
Yeah.
But, I love that.
You know, they have those little, like, just like little decorative things for your phone case. They've got mm-hmm. those phone cases that are like the size of like a dictionary. But yeah, so I always thought that that was really cool that they did these little, like, these little motifs for these characters of Gogo and Oren.
Mm-hmm. You didn't think it was actually going to be that easy
to do. Yeah, great line, great delivery. Mm-hmm. Lucy's always fierce. I think that's why I like Lucy, because she's just like,
She can deliver a line like Silly Rabbit, Tricks Are for Kids, and just knock it out of the park.
Right.
I mean,
and is that because her name's... Are we spoiling her name? Spoiler alert. Her name's Beatrix Kiddo, so it's like Tricks and Kid, or that? I don't know.
Sure.
Am I thinking too much about...
Maybe you're thinking too much about
too
it.
Too hard about this. Mm-hmm. Beatrix Kiddo.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
I mean, I feel like I'm glad that Quentin Tarantino is so protective over all of these characters that we never got, like, a Crazy 88, like, spinoff. That none of these characters kind right. of went on to multiple television shows, no spinoff movies. All we got is this movie and...
The Crazy 88
this
TV
great
show.
Scene. Yeah.
The Crazy 88 TV show is just... giving me like Jetsons Meet the Flintstones. I don't know. Yeah. Like, so
everybody
we don't need it. No one asked for
everybody running around in all of these like Kato masks.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Green Hornet, my Uncle George's favorite show. That I was always like, what's that? That's the old person show.
I mean, speaking of Green Hornet, mm-hmm. The bride's yellow tracksuit is
Bruce Lee.
Who played Kato in the Green Hornet? What
yeah.
is that Bruce Lee movie that the tracksuit is from? Here I have
Enter the Dragon.
I have a whole reference to
the movie references.
I have a whole reference to looks. It is called Game of Death.
Ooh.
The bride's yellow tracksuit is an homage to what Bruce Lee wore in that movie.
Okay.
I know that Lady Snowblood, especially, I mean, I think that a little of the plot is taken from Lady Snowblood, but I think the last fight scene with Lucy Liu, I think there's a lot of Lady Snowblood images of just kind of the little things that I know of Lady Snowblood. I think that the last fight with Uma and Lucy is kind of, those are kind of directly pulled from that movie. I love that fight scene. I did not know that the piece of score that they use is a pop song, and it's a disco song from the 70s.
I love that song.
So I always kind of knew it from this movie, because they don't ever use audio from it. They just use, like, they just use the music from it.
Right.
And I remember kind of figuring out,
like, there's no lyrics.
No, there's no lyrics. And I remember figuring out, oh, it's a song from the late 70s. It's a disco song.
You just thought it was, like, an old classic, yeah. like a Brazilian, like... Rumba.
Yeah. But I think that's so cool. Yeah. I love that song. I mean, we were looking up the soundtrack earlier. That song is 10 minutes long.
It is.
Yep. So, it I mean, is. So whenever I hear that song now, song, I just immediately think of this fight scene.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh,
and just
can't
kind
talk
of,
enough
and,
about the music.
And how this
so good.
Scene is shot by, I think it's Robert Richardson, who he's done a lot of Tarantino movies, of how this shot is filmed on the stage. It's so beautiful. And like the little
But also like
in the little in the little Zen garden.
In the House of the Blue Leaves.
I think it's sort of like a courtyard. I think it's outside. I think
on
it's
the
like,
roof.
I think it's their courtyard. And yeah. their little Zen garden and the little like fountain going up and down.
Mm-hmm. It's like a well.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of just sort of Oren Ishii's arc with the bride? Of she kind of gives her mad respect at the end of this movie.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I think, no, I guess they don't all do. I guess her and Bud. But it's very interesting that we get so much Oren story, right? Mm-hmm. We get like, this is her as a child. This is her parents died in front of her.
Well, this is probably one of the benefits of when you're doing two movies that you can do something like this, too.
True, true.
That if this was all one four-hour movie, right. maybe you don't get as much of her backstory.
Right. But we don't get that with Vernita. We don't get it with Bud, you know. So it's interesting that this character, but she is a complex character, and it's a big scene, so it's fair that she would get this intro. But...
Because she apologizes to her. That, like, she's kind of underestimates her.
Yeah.
And they kind of have some sort of a truth before she dies, which I really like in that scene.
You know, I think Uma does it, what she does really well as the bride is that she, you know, she says, like, you know, are you ready? Like, we're going to do this, you know? And she asks Vernita at one point, you know, like they have this moment where the daughter comes home and they stop, you know? So it's like, there are these rules that at least
they do have,
at least the bride has,
yeah.
you know, where she, you know, she'll stop, you know, in front of the child or she'll whatever. And, yeah, I think as like killers or whatever, the divas
this
just kind
assassin's
of
assassin's code of the divas.
And it's just game recognize the game.
I mean, even when L Driver was going to kill her in the hospital,
right.
that Bill calls her on the phone and says, "We can't do it this way."
Right. I'm surprised they even would have used poison, but I think that's L's kind of like thing is that she uses poison because she sends in the snake in the trailer
right.
in the second movie. So and Vernita's thing is the knives, and maybe Oren, I don't know what Oren's thing is, maybe it's sharpshooting. They showed that in the anime because she was a freelance assassin before this. So I feel like there are other unspoken rules in this world, like all of their specialties, right? And Elle's being poisoned, and so her going in to kill the bride that way, and Bill's like, all right, she deserves more.
Mm-hmm.
But so it's interesting.
It's cowardly to do it in her sleep.
Right. So it's interesting with Oren. Maybe she's the one that, I don't know, maybe she could recognize, you know, Beatrix as a peer, a colleague.
Yeah.
But, yeah, great. both of them are so good.
We're a little skeptical about the visual effects shot when you see her head.
When she gets scalped.
When she gets scalped.
Yeah.
I don't know how successful that shot is.
I'm dubious.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. I think it makes her head look really tall.
Yeah.
It makes her look a little cone-heady. But I think, it, like, probably if you were, like, to get, like, a ruler or whatever, it'd be like, actually, and, like, you slide in, like, the piece of her scalp that they digitally cut out.
A piece of it, sure.
Like, if you slide it in, probably it's like, actually, it's, like, really to scale. Mm-hmm. But the way her hairline is and the way her forehead is, it makes it look conehead.
Yeah.
It makes it look like, what about the I was going to do a Star Wars joke, but I can't get the line out, so we'll cut that bit. The droid attack on the Wookiees. Never mind. It's a tall headed guy. I don't know if any of our listeners are Star Wars people, but anyway, moving on.
I remember when I would take film classes and we kind of looked at feminist pieces of filmmaking. And I remember a film instructor that I had at the University of Montana really loved Uma Thurman and Kill Bill because you got this fierce female action hero, but the movie always remembers that she's a mother, too, which I think is really interesting.
Right.
That the movie doesn't have to choose sides, that we can't make this woman that can kick a lot of ass not be motherly. Uh-huh. Like, the bride, essentially, like, she's a mom, which I think is really interesting for a character.
I think
this.
The whole film theory, I probably in book two, in the second film, goes a little bit more into this mode of, like, now that she knows the child's alive, that, like, she kind of switches, motives, right?
Yeah.
In the second movie. So it's like, yeah, maybe there is a way for the two of them to just work as one long movie kind of a thing.
Yeah.
Lord of the Rings
style.
So
I remember at the New Beverly that they were doing a cut of Kill Bill, and it was called The Whole Bloody Affair.
Okay.
And it was being shown, I think, around 2011 at the New Beverly. And it had a couple-day run. I'm sure it sold out all of the nights that it did that,
right.
And I don't think it's ever been back. They regularly show both movies at the New Beverly at midnight every month.
So,
but I don't think that they do the full cut a lot.
When Kill Bill Volume 1 was released on DVD, it had some stuff on it. But it's not like...
No, it's not.
...jam-packed with special features.
It's kind of an underwhelming DVD I remember at the time.
So, this is my point. This is where I'm going. So, at the time, I'm like... Okay, where's the special edition? Oh, it'll be packaged together with volume two in like a nice two movie package.
Here we are 20 years later.
It
never came.
They never did it.
Which is so funny because Tarantino strikes me as somebody that probably has a big physical media collection.
Meanwhile, you have to buy Grindhouse together. I don't think you can buy the movies.
I think in the first release that they did release them separate.
Okay.
I think.
But you can buy them together. Our
Blu-ray copy
is one disc.
Yep.
And, you know, and it's a Blu-ray, so obviously you can watch it either way, but he's not exactly Christopher Nolan, not including chapter breaks in Memento. Isn't that a thing?
No, that is Mulholland Drive.
Mulholland
Drive doesn't have chapter breaks.
There you go.
But yeah, I'm kind of surprised with just kind of
I was
thinking
waiting. I was like, give me my two.
Tarantino is just kind of as a big movie lover and probably buys a lot of DVDs and Blu-rays.
Yeah.
And I mean, name a format and Quentin Tarantino probably has a lot of movies in that format.
Right.
That I'm kind of surprised that there hasn't really been anything issued with Kill Bill. Like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, and I feel like this is a two movie set. I guess there's no word for it. Not a trilogy, a duology. So this duology, these two movies, like they deserve better. I mean, I guess physical media is dying art form, right?
Well,
but when it was all the past 20 years, we were at the height of special edition DVDs, right? And it deserved to have this double pack, this combo pack of both movies and nice packaging. And like, we as watchers can just go and watch one or the other.
I think that there might be...
There were just the yellow one and the red one.
Yeah, the yellow one and the red one. I think that there might be international cuts or like international DVDs. That's the whole bloody affair.
Yeah.
And it just didn't make it to America. Okay. I mean, physical media is dying. But that said... Blu-ray boutique houses that reissue movies are doing very well.
They're doing the Lord's work right now.
I mean, there's a lot of good stuff that is being reissued. And it would be cool to see Kill Bill added to something like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because it deserved, especially in that renaissance, that golden age of the special edition DVD, you know, and everybody was doing it. Lord of the Rings had, you know, these beautiful sets. Matrix didn't quite. I mean, you know, you could buy all three of them or whatever. But
Jackie Brown and Pulp Fiction in their first DVD prints had nice editions.
Yeah.
And that was back when Tarantino would do commentaries.
Right.
Which I feel like anything after Jackie Brown, he didn't go back to doing commentaries for.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I know it's not everybody's cup of tea, but for people that enjoy a DVD commentary... You're listening to two of them right now, you know, and just those special editions, just all that extra stuff that we just, this is the kind, these are the kinds of movies that people are waiting for behind the scenes.
I mean, you could make an entire feature doc of just the House of the Blue Leaves.
Yeah.
Scene
yeah.
of how they made it.
There's that crazy crane shot following them in and out of the bathroom that lasts like 4 minutes, like maybe not 4 minutes, but the, you know, there's a really, really impressive single take crane shot in that at the beginning of that scene, you know. So there's any number of things that would have taken all the set pieces in House of Blue Leaves months, and there's like five of them happening in the, you know, in the third act of this movie.
I think that it's kind of a bummer with stuff like awards and Oscar that this wasn't either one of these two movies weren't Uma Thurman's second Oscar nomination.
Right.
She only has the supporting actor actress nomination for Pulp Fiction, and she has never been back. I mean, it's a genre snub. I feel like this movie would have been too out there for mainstream voters. But I will say BAFTA nominated. So she was in the conversation. 2003 is a very famous, weird Best Actress year where...
Who is it?
Say it was...
say their name.
Well, I mean, the big thing with 2003 was that all of the major precursors, it's a different five. So I believe in 2003, it was Naomi Watts for 21 Grams, Samantha Morton, who was very late-breaking for In America, Charlize Theron ends up winning for Monster... which was kind of a late-breaking movie. Then she became the clear front-runner.
Uh-huh.
Diane Keaton in Something's Gotta Give, and Keisha Castle Hughes for Whale Rider. Which I probably would sub out Keisha Castle Hughes for Whale Rider for Uma.
There you go.
Yeah. But it would have been... It was there, but it never quite made it to Oscar. Like, it had a huge moment in pop culture... But it didn't really cross over. To awards.
Some of the dialogue is cuckoo. And it's just, you what have you, to...
What are some of your favorite lines?
Oh my God. I beseech you on behalf of my daughter. What? Girl, what? I feel like Vivica's going, girl, what? Like, okay.
How Vivica is describing the fight under the cover of night. I coach Little League.
Oh yeah.
At a baseball diamond.
Your hair in a black stock.
I love how she delivers.
We have
that
a
line.
Fight.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Wearing all black. We won't be bothered. Yeah. Look, bitch, I need to know you're going to start any more shit around my baby girl. You can relax now. I'm not going to murder you in front of your child. Okay. But it's just, I don't know. It's heightened.
Yeah.
Right? It's heightened dialogue, I guess. It was not my intention to do this in front of you. For that, I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
Girl, what?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's dialogue from an old kung fu movie. Mm-hmm.
I guess, yeah.
Okay, so how were you upset in the last scene of this movie of does she know her daughter? Is she aware that her daughter is still alive?
Right.
Were you just like...
You're just like, oh, wow.
I mean, we didn't have to wait all that long because right. This movie was out in November and volume 2 was out in April.
Oh, good.
So okay, 20 like years
that.
This month.
I like that. Mm-hmm. I keep going to the Matrix, but the last two Matrix were, I feel like, less than a year apart. I think they're about three to six months
apart.
Yeah,
I think that Reloaded was, same year as this movie. Reloaded was June, and then Revolutions was November.
Wow, that's fast. But that's the thing, when you shoot these movies as one big movie, as we learned with Lord of the Rings, shoot them as one big movie and then just release them as sequels. The end of this movie is a gag.
Yeah.
You're just like, oh shit. Mm-hmm. Now we have to wait. But like you said, it was only a few months, so that's good. And now, you know, nowadays, man, I feel like with movies, you're like, oh, there's gonna be a sequel of whatever. It's like, I'll fucking see you in 5 years.
We'll see you in 2.5 years. Damn. And you better hope that there's not a writer's strike that will push it an additional 4 months.
Yeah. You know, it's like, shit, what is this, Stranger mm-hmm. Things? I expect it to be 6 years in between seasons now.
Yeah.
So it was a nice change when we were like, oh shit, this is coming out soon. Cool. Why don't they just do this all the time?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, gag. Sophie Fatale. Mm-hmm. Just like, ooh, this bitch.
That shot
chop off her other arm.
That shot of the bride kicking her down the hill to the hospital.
You laughed.
It still makes me laugh of how silly it is. kicking this like one-armed bitch down this hill.
Tell him I want him to know. Tell him I want him to know. I want him to know. Girl.
That's also very Quentin Tarantino dialogue, yeah, too.
I know.
I'm going to cut something off. For each thing that you don't tell me, I'm going to cut something off.
Yeah.
And it will be missed. Mm-hmm. Uma's so good in this movie.
With the mask on, or mm-hmm. not the mask, the motorcycle helmet. Can't see your face. Love it. Yeah. But, I don't know. It was so interesting to me that once they were released, we were just like, okay, I guess I love this DVD. I wish there was more on there.
I think that this might be one of those movies that we have multiple copies of.
Yes, it is. I think there's four or something.
I think that my DVD still has the movie store sticker on it, too.
Oh, okay. Did you buy it slightly used?
I bought it from work. Yep. Mm-hmm. I bought it from work.
I love that.
I'm also a big sucker mm-hmm. in movies. I love writing a list in movies. I mentioned that on our our She-Devil episode that I love a list and crosses something off. I love it.
Do you love
I want to see it more.
She used felt tip markers mm-hmm. and a red one to write the numbers and a black one to write the names.
Mm-hmm.
Or was it the other way around? I don't know. But she used two color felt tip markers. And the names got bigger and bigger and bigger as it went down.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think it was the second viewing that I noticed at the beginning of the movie. When she gets to Vernita Green's house, Oren Ishii is above her, crossed out already. Mm-hmm. And you don't know what that is.
Yeah.
You're just like, what is that?
Oh, shit. Mm-hmm. And then, okay, so do you think that, like, the logic of the bride, mm-hmm. and then we'll kind of wrap up the episode. Do you think the logic of the bride is that she knows that Oren Ishii is going to be the most challenging one of them all? So she's just immediately going to take care of it.
Yeah.
She wants to get the Tokyo crime lord crossed off the list.
Right.
Because it's going to be the most work.
Yeah.
And it's going to make the biggest statement, too.
Sure.
To all of them.
Yeah. She took down the entire, you know, Japanese underworld. The boss and all the minions. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. You gotta take out the hardest one first. And then everything after that is just like, okay. Knock them off one by one.
Mm-hmm.
Because it wasn't just her. It was like all of her, you know, all of her crazy 88 guys and gals. Yeah, but again, when you see it the first time, you're just kind of piecing together. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know if you even notice that there's a crossed out name.
Yeah.
You know, at first. So, interesting. Still don't know if I get it.
I'm glad that we got an opportunity to talk about this movie, because I know that listeners have been wanting us to do a Quentin Tarantino movie.
Right.
I love Quentin Tarantino. I know that you sometimes give him a hard time, but I still have mad respect for him.
Yeah, absolutely.
He is a... Can make a better movie. You mentioned it before that he's an auteur. He's making stuff that feels artistic, different.
Yeah,
I mean, for something like that, especially now in movies, is really important.
Yes.
That I like that he's doing something like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Uh-huh, and I'm looking forward to this movie. I also love just kind of his fascination with filmmaking and television of the 60s and 70s. I think stuff like that is so fucking cool. So,
yeah. Yeah, and like I said, I feel like it's very much something that I would do. Like, I don't know. I'm not saying that, like, oh, the same kind of brain as Quentin Tarantino. I'm just saying I think that that shit is cool. I appreciate that, like, and I know that I would try to sneak in all these stupid references just so that the people who like them, and the people who don't know what they are, they just think
also,
it's part of the movie.
For people that don't know what they are, they discover what the references and then they track down the source material.
Right.
And I think for something like Kill Bill, I mean, there is a wealth of references to movies in this episode that you can discover after being really into Kill Bill.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. I think Quentin is a fun director, a fun writer. I think his scripts are, even though they're crazy and the dialogue is cuckoo, I think that there's just something about the way these stories, even when they're nonlinear, that they all just kind of wrap up together. There's just something really, really, really smart about that and really fun to watch. Mm-hmm. But some of the war movies, I'm just not gonna really like war movies, you know.
I think you should give Inglourious Basterds a shot.
Right, I know everybody loves it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm not saying I'm not going to like it.
Like I mentioned, I think that Django is probably one of my least favorite that he's done.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still not bad, though.
Right,
it's still pretty good.
Yeah.
I mean, the LGBT community loves to see a lady kicking ass.
Yes.
And The Bride definitely is that.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, we have a whole nother one to look forward to, which is really cool. And like I said, like we both said, you know, we're definitely more familiar with this one.
Yeah, I am looking forward to, I mean, if you didn't already know, we're going to be doing volume 2 next week.
Yes,
so we
indeed.
Are doing both.
Made it this far in the episode, we thought we'd
tell you. I considered just doing volume 1 and not doing volume 2. But then when I was thinking, I was like, no, I think that both movies need a proper episode for.
Right,
and like
right,
we mentioned
right.
before, all of the really fun Daryl Hannah scenes are in volume 2.
Yes, yeah.
So,
yeah. Mm-hmm. And the two of us haven't sat down and properly watched volume 2 in a while. So
yeah,
it'll be
I'm
nice
looking
for
forward
us
to it.
To revisit it and see it now with all of our hindsight to see if there's anything new that we pick up on. So yeah, I'm super excited to watch the second one.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, any final thoughts on Kill Bill Volume 1?
It's streaming on Netflix right now.
It's streaming on Netflix. I mean,
if you're watching it on Netflix, I recommend turning on the subtitles because all of the Japanese was not subtitled until I turned on
Netflix
the subtitles.
Netflix is weird about Netflix is weird with stuff like that.
Yeah,
too.
they didn't put them in. I was like, I think there was supposed to be subtitles in the anime sequence, but there weren't. And then when we got to Senichiba in Okinawa, I was like, I know there's subtitles here because I remember something, and then I switched it on, and there they were. So if you're watching on Netflix, give it a shot.
Like I mentioned before, that it's movies like Kill Bill that I'll always think of the last section of high school, of just these massive movies that me and my friends were all about. Like,
yeah.
I remember going over to people's houses and just watching Kill Bill Volume 1 when it came out on DVD. I remember bringing it over from my job so we could all watch it when it first came out on DVD. And stuff like that is cool. And it's something that event movies, and it's something that I hope that young people don't... I hope that young people still do stuff like that.
They do it.
Yeah.
It was the spring of Dune 2.
Sure. Yeah.
It was a lot of Dune 2 on Twitter. And you know,
well,
I think
good.
Right,
I
now,
like
right now it's Twitter and it's making memes. And I think Dune 2, more so than the first one, I think Dune 2 got a lot of social media, a lot of Twitter, a lot of really funny memes.
Yeah, that's good.
I mean, it had the AMC popcorn bucket going for it. But I think there was a lot of good social media. So that was a really buzzy movie, like, of this year. Mm-hmm. And this was like that. You know, I think we haven't had a big, you know, blockbuster like that where there's were these event movies that everybody you know saw it, you know. That was fun about the late 90s and the early 2000s.
Yeah.
I remember sitting in the car after Return of the King going,
well, what do I have to look for?
What am I going
to
do next year? What am I going to watch next year? So we're just done? That's just it? You know? Event movies. Loved them. Still do. Mm-hmm. Dune 2. That was the last big one.
Guess we'll get to Children of Dune next. What's Dune Messiah?
I don't know what they're going to do because they made...
Oh, I know I want... Okay, we'll wrap up talking about this.
Okay.
So what do you know about this Tarantino Star Trek movie?
It's canceled.
But like what was he going to do with it?
I don't know.
You don't really know any...
I don't know what his pitch was.
There's not anything online of like a pitch.
No, I don't even know if he was going to use Chris Pine in that crew, if he was going to throw that away and do something else.
But the big thing is that it was going to be radar and violent.
I guess.
Because that is Star Trek? No, it is not.
Not
it
really.
Is not Star Trek at all.
Not really. Yeah, so I think I know about as much as you do, other than the fact that it's officially, I think he officially walked away. Mm-hmm. Because how could he do it? He's only going to make 10 movies. That's not going to be his last movie, a novelty Star Wars movie.
I think Star Trek movie. After the film critic, give him a few years and he'll be doing something.
No, of course he is. Yep. Of course he absolutely is. This is not going to be his last movie. People, listen to us. We know our odds. We're about to win the Powerball.
Well, we missed the drawing today, so.
Well, I'm manifesting that nobody's going to win. It's going to be even more, and we're going to win that one. Mm-hmm.
All right. All right, Pete, let's wrap this up.
All righty. Well, thank you for listening, everybody. This was a lot of fun. Before we go, we would like to say hello to some of our wonderful patrons.
Patreon shout out.
I think it's time for a Patreon shout out.
Let's hear them.
We'd like to say a great big thank you and hello to all of our wonderful active patrons, including Anna, Mitchie, Courtney, Christina. Oh, our friends over at How Do You Drew, Control Center. Ooh, that's our friend Andy. Kate, Pep, Tammy, Roberto, Brett, Daisy, Kelly, Chrissy, Steven, Desiree, Laura, Thomas, Lori, Brenna, Jess Rabbit, Lawrence, Lisa, Alexis, Thomas, Millie, Ted, Benny, Melanie, Susan, JJ, Shelby, Paul, Jamie, Drew, Genevieve, Don, Josh, Aaron, Nick and Shannon, Christine, and Rufino.
Thank you for being
you guys. Patreon, you guys.
There's a lot of
Patreon,
fun stuff there right
there's
now.
There's a lot of good stuff out there. We've got our TV That Made Us Gay series, micro series over on Patreon. We talk about TV shows.
We just did 90210, and you know, it's a really fun episode. I was listening to it when I was opening up the box the other day, and I was like, this is some good shit right here. This is some, like,
if I do some say quali- so
this is like a really good deep dive into 90210. So that's what you're missing on the Patreon. Yes. That is at the $5 level.
Uh-huh.
And at the $10 level, you'll get the Watch With Us commentaries. And the theme for the last 2 months that we're doing, and we're going to keep it up, we're doing anniversary movies. So we are covering the movies that just turned 25 years old.
Uh-huh. But yeah, we're doing movies from either 1994 or 1999. So movies that just turned 40 or movies that just turned 25. And that's at the $10 level. So head over to patreon.com/moviesthatmadeusgay for all of our special additional content, including playlists, behind the scenes pictures, all that fun stuff.
Yeah, so check it out. You can... But you know what is free, Pete?
What's that?
Is writing us a review on
either
Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Mm-hmm. We would love to read some kind words. It's been a while since we have gotten a review.
Yeah.
We will read it on the air. We would love to see that. But
and give us 5 stars.
Yeah, give us 5 stars. You can also follow the podcast. We're on all of the podcast platforms, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, Blue Sky. We're all there.
We're at Movies That Made Us Gay on Instagram. We post there the most.
Yeah.
So check it out. You can also follow our personals if you are so inclined. My name is Pete. I'm at Peter Lasagna on Instagram and Twitter.
I'm Scott Youngballer on Instagram, and follow my letterbox.
Yes, indeed. Thank you so much, everybody. Until next week, we'll be watching Kill Bill Volume 2.
We'll see you then.
Bye.